This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboys Talk Explode with Jordan Boyd.
Hey, this is Josh Flanagan with iFanboy.com, and I'm here today with Jordan Boyd. I don't want to say my friend Jordan Boyd is what I want to say.
I feel like that works.
That works. You are a professional comic book colorist.
Yes, indeed.
And that what's interesting to me is that was not the case when I met you. You were an aspiring comic book colorist at that time.
Yeah, you found me kind of right at the beginning of it all. That's definitely something we should probably get into because you're kind of integral to my origin story a little bit.
Well, I don't want to take that all that credit because it's the work. But from my end, here's how it would go. How long ago? 10 years ago ish.
That sounds ish.
10 years ago or so. I was making a not unconcerted effort to get some comics published. Which didn't turn out to be terribly successful before my life completely ran over all of my creative dreams. But I actually really liked a lot of stuff that came out at that time. There's lots of good pitches that got put together. They just didn't tend to get picked up for various reasons. Anyway, a thing that would happen is people would write to me and they say, hey, I've seen you trying to do stuff or whatever, and they'd send me some samples. And, they would be okay. And then I can picture where I am when I got your email. Where you sent me the same sort of thing, and I was like, "Oh, these are really good colors." And there was, I mean, like, it's a. I'm not shining your shoes, but like, there's a day and night difference between like, oh, you could be a professional, and you're just still learning how to do this. And that's what it was like. It was instantly like, oh shit, he wants to work with me. That whatever I can do.
I'm trying to remember. I guess it was. I didn't remember if I was the one that hit you up first or not.
Yeah.
But now that you say that. I even remember which pages those were because they were the free inks that Tony Moore had up on his website at the time,
right,
to play around with, which I couldn't have known that you were trying to put together a Western, but there was that one Western-y page, which is still, like, I found it a few years ago, still holds up.
Yeah, no, but there was a real difference between that and a lot of the other stuff that I'd seen, and I've always said whenever I get indie comics, for lack of a better word, or sort of like, you know, people at the beginning of their career, it's always the lettering and the coloring that instantly give it away, whether they
sure.
know what they're doing or not. So that was always super important to me. So I was really happy to get a chance to do some stuff with you. I've shown it off over the years, and like, it's you know, the best, like, they look like professional comics, because I never wanted to put anything out that wasn't up to that snuff, you know, just because there's no point.
Sure.
So... Let's go now that that's all out of the way. Where do you come from? What's your deal?
Well, let's see. Originally from Oklahoma, and at the time we met, I was living in Georgia, but now I'm in Texas.
Well,
then there was a brief interlude in Canada somewhere in the middle of all that. But yeah, just mostly Oklahoma. My family's all from Texas, so just this whole kind of flyover country, Bible Belt region, for good or ill. I went to University of Oklahoma to do film. Grew up wanting to draw comics. And somewhere along the way, let myself get talked out of that. And then discovered video editing and like how easy it was to get into digital video and all that stuff. And started thinking, yeah, that's what I want to do. And then more specifically, visual effects. So that's what I ended up, going to school for, filmmaking and visual effects. But one of my best friends in college was Sterling Gates, who we made short films together. And he went on to have a very chance encounter when he moved out to LA and ended up being Jeff Johns' like intern. And then went from there to writing Supergirl for a really long time. And now he like writes on the Flash TV show. Anyway, Sterling worked at my local comic shop and we made short films together in college. And he knew I was into comics and kind of got me back in a little harder than I had been in a few years. And when he, kind of transitioned from his film goals to his comics goals, and then when I was doing my film stuff and was actually kind of miserable doing it, he was like, you've been doing Photoshop since like 1998 and I've seen, what you can do. Have you ever thought about doing like a production job or maybe coloring or something like that? Because I could do concept art for stuff. I did matte paintings and things for visual effects. And actually, he and I met because our storyboarding project in film school, I drew a very simple scene in like a fake Ben Temple Smith 30 Days of Night style because I had read it the night that the project was due, which is actually how we connected. But that's – anyway, so he knew I could do different styles, new art, new Photoshop. Could do the job. And so I was like, you're kind of right. And I'm kind of miserable. And here's another place where you specifically fit into the story a little bit. On that terrible visual effects job that I was working, I binged iFanboy, Word Balloon, and like maybe 11 o'clock comics, a couple other podcast, like comics podcasts all at once, like would just do it all. Like that would, fill my days with work and comics podcasts, and just kind of was like, yeah, you know what, comics really was the first love. And so to make this incredibly long-winded story short, started to transition to wanting to do comics, did a portfolio or two, had some false starts, and it eventually got some traction and things kind of blew up at a certain point, which we can get into later if you want.
So when you said you wanted to draw comics and when was that? Like, how old were you when that happened?
Probably middle of high school. Like,
really?
Probably about 10th grade. I was just like, I felt like my drawing was kind of stalling out, but it's also because I was like, the kind of religious conservative upbringing, life drawing means nudity and that was bad. And, all of my how to draw books, had tastefully drawn, swimwear drawn over, in Sharpie over all of the figures, and things. So like, but I was too busy trying to draw like other people or having the brief like manga phase that everybody seems to have. I was becoming aware of the fact that I don't know that my drawing was as good as it needed to be. Which is, that's still bullshit. I should have kept pushing.
Yeah. Do you ever sort of go back to drawing now?
I think, and here's the other thing. I think I was always a stronger, pure cartoonist and not like a like more like newspaper strip kind of cartooning. I think I was actually at one point I was good at that. And I toy with it some, and I'm kind of trying to rediscover what my cartooning style would even be. And like I do little illustrations for myself or for my kids and things like picture book looking stuff, and I kind of may still do some of that, but I also don't think I want the grind of sequential storytelling in my life as much. I already have that through my coloring work.
Yeah, I understand.
Any illustration work I would do would probably not be that.
That makes complete sense, having been close up in it like you were, I'm sure. So were you like always into comics, or did you like stop and start, or when did you fall out and fall in?
I don't know that I ever fell out, but good. Like, you know, the weekly getting comics every week thing didn't start until college, really. Before then, it was always either a luxury, like, or a whim, or I would, you know, it was a thing where I can't remember, like, in second or third grade is when I really started drawing. It was when I changed schools, and like, I was like, I wanted to be one of the cool kids that were drawing, superheroes during indoor recess time. And then I was the only one that still was doing that a year later and just kept on doing it. But I mean, I remember me and my cousin getting obsessed with like the year that like the death of Superman happened. Like I remember spending, like my cousin was obsessed with the collecting aspect and I got obsessed with the story. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was at that point, it was mostly Superman and Batman stuff, you know, all the big 90s things. I did get a weird multi-pack from Walmart that had the first four issues of Youngblood and Wildcats, which was big. And then it was things like buying the Start Your Own comic book collection sets from like Toys R Us, which would just be the worst dollar bin, like leftover kind of reject issues of things. But
I remember those.
I didn't know the difference.
Right.
And so, you know, that's why I read a bunch of issues of like Sleepwalker or I'm trying to think of some of the other kind of oddball like DC books too. Some of them were like, this really doesn't belong in the like Toys R Us kids section, but no one's clearly paying attention.
Yeah.
But you know, it was whatever I could scrounge from gas stations back when that was a thing.
Yep.
Or the like, you know, bi-monthly, here's $20, get some back issues. So I was never reading much that was super current. And it was all over the place until I started making an effort to pick up Madman and like, not Hellboy yet. That was a couple years later. For some reason, the Hastings near my house always had Madman. So I was like an early, like I was into like the Dark Horsey stuff, like when I started finding it.
Were you aware?
Anyway, I could go on and on.
Yeah. Were you aware of the craft and sort of the components of it at that point?
At that point, I was like, it was a lot art centric. I'm trying to think. I mean, I actually liked Liefeld and things at the time, but I'm proud to realize now when I found some of my first comics. Apparently, I just had a thing for Mignola right away because I would always pick out the Superman back issues that had Mignola covers. Like I can picture a Superman cover where Clark's pulling like Jimmy Olsen away from Banshee, who is like in some sort of like they're on the Scottish moors and she's like in hell trying to drag like Jimmy down or whatever. Like and then there was a bunch of Elseworlds covers that had Mignola art.
Gotham by Gaslight.
I didn't have Gotham by Gaslight, and I had one where it was like, it was all just the covers.
Sure.
But you know, the one where, you know, Clark is basically Mowgli from the Jungle Book, or you know, just all those different ones. So as I go through my old stuff, I'm like, oh, apparently I just always had a big old Mignola crush from the start. But anyway, yeah. I mean, the art was there, and I, you know, would say I was into the storytelling, but I don't think I really appreciated the craft until college.
Yeah. That's still not so. So when were you aware of colorists as a thing?
Around the time I wanted to be one.
Yeah. Okay.
if you don't count the early Alex Ross infatuation, Kingdom Come and Marvels were kind of like big deals for me.
Yeah, they were big deals.
Well, for sure. But like, but I'm saying like, that was a defining, like, oh, it can, this is what it can look like. Holy shit.
Oh, really? It's funny because, like, the thing for that would be for most people is like, oh, it's painted. It's so, and you know, maybe not even so much then, but now we look at it and we're like, it's so handcrafted. Whereas, yeah, you know, whereas most stuff is not, you know, not even really physical anymore. So,
right.
I guess in the other side, like at the time though, it was literally as manual, you know, as analog as anything else. It was just that paintbrush, I guess.
And it was just a level of polish that, you know.
Yeah.
I wasn't used to seeing.
Do you still like that? Like, if you look back at it,
I would be interested to revisit it. It's been a long time since I read either Marvel's or Kingdom Come.
Mm-hmm.
Now I find that stuff in, like, as I see it now, like stuff like that now, I find it too kind of Baroque.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think my current ideal for what comic books should look like, you know, I'm not, this is personal taste. This isn't like me making a manifesto or anything. The combo of Darwin Cook and Dave Stewart on New Frontier and Dave Stewart and Guy Davis on early BPRD are pretty much like my platonic ideal of what comic books should look like.
Yeah.
I definitely kind of ranged away from the painted stuff, even though like I see painterly influences in my coloring work for sure. It's getting more subtle, like, though, and not as like rendery. Mm-hmm. For sure.
So your pal Sterling, he hips you to this idea, and like, where do you go from there? You think, well, I want to be a comic colorist, and then where do you start?
It was a combo of Twitter starting to become a thing, and comics people being very generous with time and feedback. You know, things like Comic Twart were kind of kicking off. Mm-hmm. Things like, all the podcasts I was listening to kind of clued me into, who was doing work that I was excited about at the time. And so I was, you know, following specific people and seeing, you know, kind of what niches I might fill or what styles I was interested in. It really just came down to, I need art for samples. Uh-huh. And that meant scouring the internet and learning. Well, again, Photoshop has like been my bread and butter since like 1999. So like, I know how to resize kind of thumbnail quality inks to a degree that they're passable at like certain resolutions to still color them. Mm-hmm. So I was able to find like scans of people's commissions or other art and either share it on Twitter or like put it up on like a Tumblr or something like that. And although that was a little later, I can't remember. I had a website based off some other terrible like content management thing. Anyway, the short version is I had a print portfolio that I decided I was going to take to shows. I knew that Marvel and DC would accept portfolio submissions at like San Diego, and you might get a review like with somebody. Mm-hmm. And so in one summer I planned to go, and this was when I was in Georgia. So I went to, what was it called?
Dragon Con.
It was like FX no. Con, I okay. think, which was in Orlando.
Okay.
I was going to go to FX Con, which was a small show. And then I was going to go to San Diego. Well, I went to San Diego, and we met briefly there.
Yeah.
But I did not get chosen for a portfolio review. So that was like the biggest waste of money. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. There was a really nice guy that was doing something. I'm going to get it wrong. So I'm not going to try there. The only good review I got from anybody was, from a semi-drunk pro at a bar, who was in no position to like recommend me for anything, but he like was encouraging, and I was like, okay, well, I know it was just bad timing and me being kind of not good at socializing enough to like get into the right situations and knowing the right people. Anyway.
But so you didn't meet anybody that time out that like you followed up.
That was a pretty disheartening and expensive flub. But then I went to FXCon like right after, and there was like nobody at this show. And it was right before all these people blew up. It was Hickman, who had just signed his Marvel exclusive, Matt Kent, Francesco Francavilla, and like, I'm gonna forget a couple people. There was like two or three other people that were just on the cusp of like of the kind of blowing up that they were gonna do within the next 6 months to a year. Mm-hmm. And because no one was there, I had a lot of time with all of them, and they were all like, yeah, you're ready. You just gotta put into the right in front of the right eyeballs. And Hickman gave me maybe still the best portfolio review of my life, because like I enjoy, you know, art school, you know, prepares you for harsh criticism and things like that. So I'm like, and I knew he was not going to be shy if he didn't like something. And he gave some of the best advice. You know, he was like, you know, some of these are not pro artists that are in your samples. You should always make sure that you are using the best art from the best people, because that's what tells Marvel and DC that you bring quality to the table that they are missing. Because if you can make the best of the best look good, then you're inherently valuable and they will want you. Don't be afraid to do stuff in a way that's more weird or like expressionistic, because anybody can do the local color, you know, grass is green, sky is blue stuff. Get as weird and wild with it as you want. And people will probably be more interested. He was just really honest. And again, gave me an almost 45 minutes to an hour of his time, which I've always been incredibly thankful for. Because again, nobody was at that show. That cost me almost nothing to go to. And that gave me all the confidence and like advice and all that mm-hmm. that could have ever wanted. So then I just hit it harder. You know, I emailed you because I knew you were looking for somebody to do something with, and, you know, started talking to people on Twitter, and, you know, it kind of fizzled out for about a year. I can't remember what all, but then, but a bunch of people knew who I was and were kind of pulling for me. Mm-hmm. And then Nate Cosby over at Dynamite, he formerly of Marvel, he had just started running a bunch of different things at Dynamite, put out one of his kind of now frequent calls for colorists or artists on Twitter. And he randomly replied to me, and like within a week I was working on King's Watch with Jeff Parker and Mark Lamming.
Oh, wow.
Which was the Shadow the Phantom, Flash Gordon, and what's his name? The magician. Mandrake the magician.
Oh, geez.
Fighting, you know, Ming the Merciless invading the earth or whatever. So, and from there, I did a cover with Gabe Hardman on a Magnus the Robot Fighter thing, right as he was like looking for a new colorist on Star Wars Legacy. So within like a month of King's Watch coming out, I was doing more King's Watch. I was doing a bunch of covers, and then I was doing Star Wars Legacy with Gabe, which was kind of a mind fuck. Can I say fuck?
I remember that came on really pretty fast.
What's
interesting about it is like, I know those people. Like, it's really weird to me that you're like, that you came up with people who like, I actually have relationships with, and it's unrelated to me. As far as I understand.
Right.
And it's just like, there's little, like, I don't know, these little pockets of the comics community that get along with each other.
Well,
for whatever reason.
And I was interacting with like Declan and Jordy and a couple people on mm-hmm. Twitter at that point already, who were again, all being really supportive and just generous with their time, you know, just talking to me about stuff, which that was the wonderful thing about Twitter about 10 years ago.
Yes, it was. It's a whole different ballgame now, but yeah, you're right.
It's hard to even imagine it being this positive force in my life.
Funny because a lot of the folks that are like working pros now, yourself and Mitch Gerrits is, I think, a good example, sort of came up around the same time with the same sort of thing. And, you know, Twitter was you know, essential to the ascendance of these folks. Twart, you know, is one of those things where comic Twart was, it was a huge deal for just this certain crop, this class of people that I think that you are, you know, parallel with.
It's weird because, like, I've only, like, other than a couple of them, only recently started kind of talking with all of them, even though, like, and they were all, like, 6 months to a year ahead of me little bit. And so that's been interesting, just being, and it's all, but it's also, I found my own weird little crew, mm-hmm. not as much through Twitter, so much as, a group of people that I was, I mean, just essential. 'Cause I was working a day job when I was first starting, and, I'm trying to remember whose idea originally was, probably Marissa, a colorist named Marissa Louise, who works on a lot of DC, like Vertigo and other things now, her and, I'm just gonna start naming names. My friend Brian Level, Tamara Bonvillain, Ramon mm-hmm. Villalobos, Nick Barber, and a handful of other people. We became this weird little club that not really a club, but we were all, you know, night owls working late, weird hours, and would get on Google Hangout and would just sit with the mic on for 5 or 6 hours every night while we would all be doing our pages and our random work. And you know, Ella and Chris Sabella was part of that group at that point too. Mm-hmm. So like, so, you know, now it's this weird thing where we all kind of, you know, we all still keep in touch. We all still pretty close, but that core group there have all kind of graduated into, well, I mean, Tamara got nominated for coloring last week and, mm-hmm. Chris is, you know, Crowded got nominated and Green Lantern Earth One got nominated. We're all kind of coming into our own now, and that's kind of cool, and we're like the wave behind the twart crew a little bit.
So let me take it back a little tiny bit there. And so what's interesting to me is that you were really learning while you were doing on the job. It's not as if you'd come up in a bunch of like really indie comics that were getting published, and you know, like, you pretty quickly went from like, here's what my stuff looks like, to working on pro stuff. You know, like, what did you...
Some of that is because digital art was a thing I was already familiar with. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was doing, you know, digital illustration and concept art and matte paintings and, you know, digital image make and like, image, you know, manipulation and retouching. So, like, some of it was, like, you know, and having an art history, you know, minor and all that stuff. Like, I knew art, I knew the technology.
And that really did translate? Like is sort of seamlessly.
I mean, it's that and just like, you know, it was just putting in the hours. I mean, I definitely put in the
10,000
hours thing. Like that was, I mean, yeah. But also, you know, the challenge and like thrill of learning new things is kind of like kind of like my whole deal. Mm-hmm. So, which is why all of my hobbies end up becoming things I want to make into careers. Probably a little bit.
Was there anything that you know now that you wish you'd known then, though? Outside like the craft part, not time management or what, you know, business, you know, like, but sort of like, oh, I wasted time doing this or, you know, like designing for print as opposed to digital or anything like that?
I mean, there was definitely, well, I mean, okay, some of that those early samples I was doing, and mm-hmm. I think this was something that held me back, was because I had been doing stuff for purely digital, mm-hmm. you know, final product. Like, I remember in Dave McKeag's old colorist forum, Gutter Zombie, which is another huge part of my, like, mm-hmm. starting out, because people like Dave or Laura Martin, or John Roush or some of those people would be around in that forum and would give really good critiques of mm-hmm. everybody that posted, which is bananas. Really.
Does anything like that exist anymore?
Nope. Cause there's not a central hub as much. That's, I mean, crazy. Well, you know what? I take that back. I think it's starting. And I think, Nick Filardi's, Discord group is becoming that a little bit. Huh. So, like, you know, Discord is kind of like Slack, but it was originally for gamers, and we're all kind of, a lot of my friends are moving over to it for managing, like, kind of like smaller social media circles almost, instead of, so where, like, private conversations happen, you know. Like, so Nick, who also does like Twitch streams now of coloring and tutorial stuff, his Discord group has like, it's kind of blown up in the last year around his like streaming schedule. And like, I think it's becoming what Gutter Zombie was back in the day, which is cool to see. Cause, I wouldn't have had a clue how to handle, you know, how dark my like digital, you know, painting was at the time and figure out how to bring all that back up to what would print in a way that works. And I went from being like, everything was way too dark to I was too worried about that. And like would do things with like where nothing would print with black ink. Mm-hmm. Like, but weirdly that taught me color theory better than I had previously grasped it before. And so now it's just still part of my process sometimes. Introducing constraints was mm-hmm. a huge part of me developing a style that was fast enough to keep up with the merry-go-round of monthly comics scheduling.
So what was the biggest challenge for you at that early point?
Finding art that didn't suck, to try and get, do samples of, that felt like the kind of stuff I wanted to be doing. That was my thing. Cause like, I enjoy superhero stuff, but I don't actually think that's my strongest. I don't think that's my strongest work or my like passion. Like, you know, I prefer kind of grittier, textury kind of horror, sci-fi, crime, you know, that kind of realm. Because, and I think that's some of my film background. I like cinematic lighting and, you know, more moody, atmospheric stuff. Not that superhero comics don't have that. Just it's a crapshoot whether that's going to be what you're on.
Right.
And, you know, you kind of are stuck making sure that every character is in their trademark colors a little bit. Anyway, but like things like Tony Moore's samples where he had, you know, that Western kind of horror pages and like Walking Dead pages. He had and Fear Agent pages. Those became like those were when I think my portfolio started to catch people's attention too. Not just because of my work, but because it's really not hard to make Tony look good too. Cause he's real good.
He is real good.
So yeah, it was a matter of finding samples that let me do something interesting on that was like, here's the work that I want to be doing. And that was part of it.
Do you consider yourself to have a style?
I think I probably do. I would not know how to describe it because it is still pretty different between the different books. Mm-hmm. I think I have a palette. I don't know that I have a rendering style, but I have a palette and some tendencies that probably mm-hmm. recur. I think I tend to prefer warmer palettes, even for things like night scenes and stuff like that. I just there's something about playing with warm nights and like keeping things like from being too cool. I don't know why. It's a thing that I do a lot, and people have pointed out to me that I rarely go full, you know, cool blues and greens and purples. Texture.
Do you find that people, I don't think fandom largely is fluent in that type of language. And I only am in the vaguest sort of notion, but like beyond even just say maybe the artists that you're working with or other colorists are comic book professionals fluent in that sort of language and stuff? Or is it more like they know what they like?
Artists tend to be, and you know, I've been lucky with the people I've worked with too. Writers like Rick, Reminder have like, they're artists too. So like,
right.
And you know, anymore, Gabe, you know, writes everything with Karina now. So like, a lot of the writers I work with are artists too. Mm-hmm. So that helps. And I don't know. This isn't to like crap on fandom at large, but I feel like my audience, like the people that I'm whose feedback I cherish and who, like, who are the ones that actually notice things really mm-hmm. tend to be the artists. Like, I rarely hear from fans as much, especially like at shows. Like mm-hmm. if I table at a convention, you know, anybody that comes, most people that come to my table, if they knew who I am, they probably already have everything. Or they're, you know, the person trying to just get signatures from everybody.
Right.
Already. But the people that come to my table all excited are usually artists that I haven't worked with before, or like, or artists I have, like, they're my audience.
Right.
there's the dual part of that is they're also my job security too. Sure. 'Cause artists wanting to work with me is pretty much the only way I'm going to have longevity in the industry. So,
yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, I've spent the larger part of my adult life learning to talk about comics, and I still don't feel like I have the language. Like, I can say, oh, this color, this is good color, this is not great color, but I don't always know, even if I know why, I don't know that I have a language to talk about that, or even, and certainly not to get into the nuance like you're able to. And I'm wondering, when I talk to letterers, I know that the deal with lettering is, and I don't mean to lump you in with letters, but you know where I'm getting at. You know, when you talk to letterers, their job is to sort of not be noticed. And I'm
sure,
as a colorist, do you think in those terms? Like, where do you place yourself in the overall sort of mix of what makes up a comic book? Like, what do you view your role as? Does it change?
It's interesting because, and we actually debate about this a fair amount, like internally, colorists, we kind of talk about this some. Like, we think there's a lot of times when fans and readers are responding to a combo of us and the artist, but only attributing what they're responding to the artist.
Uh-huh.
And that's not in like an arrogant people just don't appreciate what we're bringing to the table kind of a thing, so much as like, I think it's really hard for most people to separate the ink from what the colorist is doing.
Uh-huh.
And so there kind of isn't always a clear ability for people or reviewers even to distinguish why something's working because of one versus the other, or a symphony of the two together. I think of my job as clarity, bringing clarity, making sure that the clarity of the storytelling is maintained and accentuated, and that my job's not to be overbearing. It's not to it's to make sure that the artist looks as good as they possibly can. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, it really, like, that's a, it it is and it is a job more of embellishment and improvement than of anything else. Like, you're just there to make them look good. And mm-hmm. it's sometimes hard to objectively know what that means. Like, and so I don't know, but I also think it's a lot of trial and error and just knowing based off of my taste, what looks right to me. So it's, although there are a lot of tricks for like, okay, this person's talking, I want to make sure they're where the eye is, you know, going in this panel. You know, so they need to be brighter or warmer, you know, the background needs to be darker, foreground people need to be silhouetted a little bit, you know, the stuff like that. There's tricks like that that make storytelling work better. But for the most part, it's mostly just maintaining the intent of the artist and just trying to make them look like, you know, rock stars.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that difficult? Like, does your ego ever find that difficult to sort of deal with? I'm sure there are some people who do, but like how do you look at it?
Weirdly, no. I actually have the reverse, and I will not name names, but there are times where you're working on something and you feel like the artist is not as good, maybe, and you mm-hmm. feel like that, like, you would think that working on somebody's stuff that you love would be more intimidating, but I've actually tended to find that was easier because And it might just be because I like them because they complement my own style too. Like if I, again, if I have one, I don't even know how I would classify that. But anyway, when you're working on art that maybe is not as good and you feel like you're having to, and I feel like I'm having to, like the bringing clarity to the situation thing is real hard.
Interesting.
And it's also, and you know, you just want you.
And if you've done a good job, then you will not be noticed for it.
Right. Right. And like, and there, yeah, exactly. And you do, but you also don't want to get, like, I feel like there have been times where maybe something I worked on, might have hurt me because it's hard, again, because it's hard to distinguish what the colorist is doing versus what the artist is doing. If it just looks bad in the end, you know, I still feel like I'm kind of lumped in with that. I don't want to talk shitty about anybody.
No, but as a concept, I think it's an interesting, like, challenge that I don't think that readers necessarily think about. It's an interesting perspective for me, even, you know, having talked a lot about this stuff, I don't think I've considered that. And, you know, like it's sort of like, but do other pros notice that? Like, have you ever gotten, and again, this isn't about you talking about shit or anything. I'm curious about like who out there has the ability to sort of recognize the strength of the work. Or in the sort of what kind of professionals do, like, will an editor be able to spot that kind of thing? Or is it just like only colorists can tell?
I mean, certain editors for sure can. Cool. And that's why they're good at their job. Uh-huh. But they're also diplomats by design a little bit. So it's not going to be like, this looked like shit until you came along. you might hear that at a bar, at a con later down the line, you know, from somebody but artists in general are pretty sharp because they know how they like to be colored. And I've learned a lot from listening to artists in certain other, either Skype or Google Hangout groups. It's a whole thing. Anyway, hearing them have very strong opinions about stuff that I even like sometimes, but they hate. And it's always interesting to hear, you know, they think so-and-so is overworking this one artist or, you know, this person's just, you know, phoning it in or what. There's it's pretty self-regulating between colorists and artists all talking to each other. And it's not that it's all shit talky gossip, but like, you know, we're all opinionated because it's kind of our job to have taste in the, like, so we all have strong views about what does and doesn't work and we'll argue incessantly about it. And, even when I disagree, I still learn new ways to think about, problem solving. Cause that's still what coloring is in a lot of ways, is it's a problem solving as much as it is an aesthetic, kind of discipline.
When you're working, like say on a big two book or like, you know, an editorial staff behind it, are you doing most of your collaboration with the artist directly or is it through an editor or anything?
It depends. If it's a book where I have a previous relationship with the artist, which more and more is becoming the case, like I just have people that I tend to work with. You know, it's just who's CC'd on the email chain. But you know, if it's, you know, a lot of Marvel stuff in particular, I feel like I'm mostly talking to an editor unless there's a problem or if a book's running late and an artist is having to send me inks directly or something like that. But you know, I don't know. A lot of my work the last couple of years has been with people that I am pretty tight with personally. So it like just kind of tends to happen that we all are pretty, we're all on the thread.
I mean, do you think you set your career up that way or is it just happened that way? Cause it sounds like, if I was you, that's the way I would want to have it too.
It is for sure. I mean, my mantra and pretty much if I wasn't doing comics, if I was doing movies or whatever, that any of the creative endeavors that I would want to be a part of, just making cool stuff with cool people is kind of like, it is a, it is a social thing too. That is definitely a by design kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So, at what point would you consider, when were you able to quit your day job, and when were you able to do this as your career?
Let's see. I was doing King's Watch at Dynamite. I was doing Star Wars Legacy at Dark Horse, which was still one of the better page rates I've ever gotten.
Really?
Still.
I guess because it was Star Wars.
Yeah, and it's about commensurate with what I make on those things now. But at the time, I was like, oh, shit, if I can get this rate on everything, I will be good. Which didn't happen for a while. So I was doing King's Watch, Star Wars Legacy, and I did a book called Knuckleheads with my friend Robert Wilson and Brian Winkler, who were both in Oklahoma City at the same time, which got put out through
Oni?
Monkey Brain, and then IDW put out the trade. Let's see. Oh, and I did The Adventures of Miraculous or something, Adventures of Miranda Mercury with, I'm going to forget everybody's name, which Archaea put out. There was like a couple drips and drabs of stuff that was coming out, way after I'd already done the work. But, and then I did Umbral, which was an Image book with Anthony Johnston and Chris Mitten. I was doing okay doing those and my day job. It was getting to be a lot. That's why I was staying up till, 4 in the morning with Google Hangout friends, all the time. But I had in my head, when I get a Marvel gig that's ongoing or a DC gig, at DC I had no ends with at the time. Marvel seemed more likely, and it was. When I got Ant-Man at Marvel was when I called it on the day job. Mm-hmm. I've had more work than I probably even should have taken on ever since. So
how long ago was that? I'm trying to think of which Ant-Man was that.
That was the beginning of the Spencer.
Next
Spencer run.
Okay. Got it.
There was a couple different, it was actually two different books. I know it ended up being 20 something issues in total. But I can't remember what the adjective was on the first one.
Yeah,
or if the first one was just Ant-Man and the next one was the something Ant-Man.
It was with the bear guy.
It was when he moved to Miami and started the security agency and stuff. And man, I loved that book. And even watching Endgame this last weekend, I was just like, man, Ant-Man's still my boy.
Yeah, that would have been around the time of the first Ant-Man, because that was the...
For sure. Scott Lang it was definitely the, here's the book we want people to look at when the movie comes out kind of thing.
Cool.
So that was when it became official. This is what I do now.
And was that satisfying at that point, or was it about time?
Oh, it was a mix of both. When I got a Star Wars book with Gabriel Hardman right off the bat, I was pretty much even if this all just falls to shit in another year, that's a pretty cool thing to get to do.
I know that I knew you were good at the thing you do, but when I saw that happening, I thought, oh, he's definitely got it. Because I know that Gabe does not mince his Gabe
put
wants
up, put nothing, up with anything.
With nothing. With nothing. And I was like, well, it made me feel good, because I was like, if I could recognize that you had the stuff it took, and then, Gabe, who is much more discerning than I am, also thought that, I was like, oh, awesome, way to go, Jordan. I genuinely thought that, because I know that he has very specific sort of tastes and standards for that kind of stuff, and that you've also continued to work with him all that time to the recently Eisner-nominated Green Lantern book that you guys did, so... That's kind of awesome.
Well, it was, and thank you. Yeah, no, I felt more safe. Okay, people who I respect and people I know, the imposter syndrome thing still crops up when it shows sometimes when I'm hanging out with people. But it was things like working with Gabe and Karina, or having Rick ask me to take over on Deadly Class, where I was like, well, I am just going to have to tell myself that I'm good enough at this point. And stop having them like minor panic attacks about like, are people just nice? Are people just nice? Mm. this sounds arrogant, but I was like, Rick has the best eye for art. Like, in this business, I think
he does. I mean, no, you're not wrong. He does.
It's just not even close. Like, I can't think of anybody who curates their collaborators as well.
I think Hickman's another guy who's really good at it, who you mentioned. Joe Casey doesn't do as much of it anymore, but he was always that guy. He could pick out guys, you know, to work with, and he wasn't an artist, whereas, you know, Hickman and Remender are. I always tend to think, but there's certain, you know, comic book writers, and I'm doing air quotes because that also sort of changes around, but like, who just, and you know, Rick's another one. He's like, no, I'm not going to work with anybody but the people who I really love and respect. And God, it just shows in their body of work, you know, like, it just,
for sure,
there's no clunkers, because they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't take that fill-in guy. They wouldn't take that house guy who we don't really know. And, you know, is fine, but not that interesting. And I think I wish the market sort of respected that more, but it does respect it enough that it lets those people have strong enough careers.
For sure. And so, you know, it was stuff like that where I was like, okay, as long as I just don't fuck up royally or have like an eye injury or something, mm-hmm. like, I can probably keep doing this.
So how does this affect your sort of enjoyment of comic books? What do you see about the medium now? Or like, how do you see it differently than you used to?
What sucks is I literally have no time to follow anything anymore. I will go on benders on, you know, Amazon, or go into a shop and just buy a big stack of stuff. I'm like, I know I need to get caught up on X, Y, and Z, or I'll see previews or see people posting, you know, stuff that they're working on Twitter. I'm like, God, that looks fantastic. And then it just kind of piles up, and I'll browse it all. But please don't ask me what I'm reading, because I could not answer it right in a way that would not be either a lie or just me looking at my shelf and being like, I guess I'm looking at those right now. I don't know. I have a harder time enjoying things that aren't just really good.
Sure.
whereas I used to follow characters and things a little bit more closely. I have to know that something's either going to be, I pretty much have to know something's going to be really interesting for me to even bother anymore. But I've also gotten weird about just reading random European stuff that I don't actually know anything about. Like, I'm trying to think. I'm not gonna get names wrong, and nothing's in front of me, so I can't list anything.
I understand that.
To back up these claims. I don't know. I get just tired too. So it's like the last thing I want to look at the end of a day of doing, you know, mm-hmm. 4 to 8 pages of something is to look at more comic books, which is kind of sad, but it just means that I've had to find other things that give me that are like the hobby enjoyment of it that I do kind of miss out on now.
Well, that's what
not
happens.
Not that I don't still love things when sure. I do read them. It's just the like, oh, what do I turn to at the end of the day? Mm-hmm. It isn't usually comics anymore.
Well, when you make your hobby and your passion your job, that can happen.
For sure. Now I just play Dungeons and Dragons with people, and that's like my hobby.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. when you're looking at other art, this is a question I've actually had, is as a colorist, you know, there's the digital schism, basically. There's when comics went digital. Do you ever look at the art from before that and look at the color in any sort of meaningful way, or? Do you think about it in those terms?
Weirdly, yes, because I, in the last couple of years, have started. I can't remember the name of the process, or like a lot of pre-digital coloring still seems like magic to me.
Yeah,
like that anybody could think that way. Like I see the color guides where they were just like futzing around with like different dye mixtures and having to blog all of them to send to like production people to actually execute. Like that just I could never.
It's
have done
insane.
It at that point.
And I don't even fully understand it, but I know that there was a person called a separator, and just whatever that entails, it just boggles my mind.
Sounds like the worst.
It does.
I look at things from like the late 80s. I can't remember what printing technology this was where, and you know, I guess Dark Knight Returns did this a little bit. I'm thinking like Cosmic Odyssey to come back to the Mignola kind of realm. That stuff where there is like a painterly, not quite watercolor, but like there's definitely kind of variation and texture to it. It's not just flat color, but it's still pre-digital.
Right.
There's something about that stuff that I've been looking at a lot and I find really pleasing. That or again, European stuff, like the way certain like Mobius stories, like, yeah, they're mostly flat, but they're still like I can see wash. I can see like grain of like the paper and like there's paint involved. And like there's something about all that to me that is alchemy, that is magical. And that I try and capture a little bit even in my work, even though I work purely digitally. Like I like having a little bit of paper texture in there, and like even if it's artificial, like I like the artifice of it feeling like there is a hand or a chemical or a you know. Something happening that isn't just, you know, pixels. And it's fake, but, it adds something to it for me, that I respond to. And I guess it's possible that might be what my style might be or what people might respond to in my work. I don't know.
I think that one of the things that happens in translation is that, you know, you as the artist, give it all these specific thoughts that you're doing. Now, that doesn't necessarily translate literally to the person reading it, but I think that care does, that thoughtfulness does. Like, you don't necessarily know why it works, but you know it does.
I've always had to believe that because I don't know any other way to work. I think about like Guillermo del Toro films, where I know from like director's commentaries and things like the insane level of like thinking about every little prop color choice or, you know, just some of those things that are all important to the people making it and probably only register on a subconscious level to the consumer. You know, I've always had to believe for my own sanity that means something, to people. And that's why people respond to certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise I probably am spinning my wheels on a lot of stuff that no one else but me cares about.
I mean, that's what comics is. I mean, if they're being done well, if they're not, then I don't want to know. Like, I don't want that. I want that to be happening. I don't want the opposite. Like, they won't know the difference. It's shit. Who cares? You know, like that thought is deadly to me. And I know it exists.
Oh, for sure. And there are times where we all are guilty of it.
You gotta make the donuts.
Yeah, you gotta. It is. Well, and that's a big part of colorists and letters, like entire lifestyle too. Is, you know, they're you know, ideally, you know, you have a book or so, a book, maybe a book and a half a week that you have to work on. But you know, one artist is late, or one, you know, print deadline gets moved, or you know, I'm sick, or my kids are sick, or you know, one day gets missed that was crucial, and all of a sudden everything's due in like a week and a half period that should have had, you know, a month, it can play havoc with everything.
Well, that was actually the next area I was going to go to is like, how have you worked out what your time management is in this? Because comics will grind a freelance to the ground if you're good enough and they give you enough work and you let them, you know, I'm assuming that, you know, learning the craft is one thing, but learning that side of it all is a whole other ball game.
I feel like I'm still learning horribly difficult lessons every year at various points. It was around the time my son was born 3 years ago, when some things just had to change, or I was just going to be dead. there was just no amount of, no way I could not go without sleep the way I had up to that point. My body wouldn't let me. I've hit a point now where I couldn't even pull an all-nighter if I wanted to. Like, my body would just die. It would just give out on me.
Right.
Or I'd get sick instantly, and it all spirals out of control really easily. So I've just gotten better about saying to myself, around, 5:45, 6 o'clock, I'm done. If I have an hour later where I feel like I'm still like lights on, or if I absolutely have to have something done for the morning, I can maybe put in 3 or 4 hours in the evening, but none of the like staying up till 4 o'clock in the morning, like half the days of the week that I used to do. Trying to be as honest with myself, because I'm prone to wishful thinking, because I think, back in the day I could do this whole, issue in 2.5 days if I had to. And so then it's just like, well, I might have to, so let's just count on that being the plan. And then it kind of can fall apart, and I'm bad sometimes about having that wishful thinking carry over to what I think is my honest assessment of how long something's going to take. Mm-hmm. And that's always the give and take of it, is I want to be as honest as possible with editors if they want somebody else to help, carry the load, or if I'm, or we need to maybe move a deadline or whatever, it's a process. I mean, there are times where I screw up. There are times where other people screw up. There are times where things are just out of my hands. Anymore, I'm getting better at drawing boundaries, I guess is what I'm saying, about giving myself permission to either say, I literally cannot make this happen, or advocating for myself, like, yeah, I might even be able to do this, but I shouldn't have to, because I'm a human being who should be able to get a night's sleep occasionally.
Mm-hmm. That conversation has been part of the, certainly I've seen it among, social media with comics professionals, and I feel like a lot more light has been shined on this, because there was definitely like, it's not as prevalent, but there's still an Iron Man sort of attitude to some comics folks, but it's softened. Like, have you noticed, like, how does that seem from the industry standpoint, from editorial? Like, is there a understanding of that? People have families, people have, they're not children anymore. They can't do that. Like, what's been your experience with that? And you don't have to throw them under a bus.
I've tended to have pretty good experiences with people. There's always the fear. There's always a huge amount of anxiety and fear, that if something happens and I can't deliver on something, or if I feel like I'm the problem on something, or if I'm making somebody else's life hard, I'm always like, well, I guess that bridge is burnt. I'll never hear from these people again. And, so far that hasn't really happened. Some people, almost always people say the right things. It's always like, well, of course family comes first, or, you got to take care of yourself. But, there's always the part of you that wonders, do they really mean that? Or are they just saying that because they know they can't say anything else? I will not name a name here. There is an old and beloved pro artist who, faked accidentally CCing me on an email to complain about me to an inker. That was maybe the worst case of this I've ever seen, where the editors were fine with everything that was going on, because this was when around the time our son was born, and you know, there was some health scares, and I was like a day late on a book that wasn't going to press for like two more months. And it was clear that the artist just didn't like me for various reasons, and CC'd his inker to say how unprofessional I was for playing the sick wife card and all this other kind of stuff. And I quit that book, and the editors were suitably horrified, and you know, it was all good. It all had upside for me, but it was like shocking. It was shocking behavior.
Wow.
From somebody I had previously admired. I will not name names.
No, I'm not. I wouldn't expect you to on recording,
but I'll tell you privately.
I don't know. Actually, sometimes I don't want to know. It's funny. Like I've met, my record of like people I've met being cool is extremely high. There's a couple more people who I've decided I just don't want to meet because I don't want to know. I don't want to chance it. Like it's funny because you were talking about Mignola. Mignola is the one I drew the line on. I didn't want to interview him. I didn't want to meet him. I don't want to know anything else about him. I just want the work.
Yeah, I don't. If I met him and he was a dick to me or something, that would be a real problem.
Yeah.
Like I would have a real hard time with that.
And I don't think that would happen. I honestly have not heard that about the man. I've never heard anything bad. It isn't that. I just went, you know, no, I'm not. Garth Ennis is another one. Like, I did an interview with him one time, and I just thought, you know what? I don't want to know anything else. In fact, I won't even listen to other people's interviews with him. I don't want to know. I just want the work.
Yeah. I have that for sure.
Yeah.
I would have no idea what to even talk about with Grant Morrison, but I wish I could be a fly on the wall. or I don't know, take hallucinogens or something with him, but like I have no idea what I would talk to with the man. But you know, it's one of those people whose work has meant a lot to me, so it's it's probably better just to keep that barrier.
My idea with Grant Morrison is that like if you got to know him and he'd be just a real dude and you'd burst through that facade of his image that he's got. I knew a guy.
Right. He just has such a very curated like persona.
Right.
And I kind of want that to be maintained a little bit.
Yep. No, that's true. I knew a guy who used to talk to him like all the time on the phone. And I was like, what must that be like? And this was way back when, you know, like before I knew a lot of people. And I just thought, that's amazing. He uses a phone? he would use a scrying dish and ravens and shit.
I think what I want more than anything is I just wish we could get Morrison to like just review a bunch of random pop culture on a daily basis, because I just think his viewpoint is always so off kilter. Like just not it's never as straightforward or he's the best.
have you read Super Gods?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's a bit in there that changed my entire outlook on comics. It changed completely how I look at comic books. And that's, like, well into this iFanboy thing, where he basically was like, they're supposed to be fun. It should be silly. Why does Batman have to be serious? Who cares how he got there? And I was like, oh, it changed everything for me. Like, in a paragraph. And I will never forget. Yeah.
It was somewhere, I think, I can't remember which issue number it is, All-Star Superman, the one kind of the one where he's wrapping up all of his loose ends or whatever. That issue of that comic book is almost like a religious text for me. Like that was just something that just like something primal clicked in me about everything that the people talk about superheroes being myths that resonate and all that. And like so that his work's always hit me on a level like that, which is clearly what he's aiming for.
Yeah.
And Super Gods, you know, elucidated all that a lot too.
Yeah.
But yeah, good stuff.
Definitely. So, like to wrap it up, I guess, like you're coloring comics, you're making it, you're doing the thing. Like, do you think about, like, where do I go from here? What's next? Or is this the thing that you're doing? And is that cool? Or is that too existential a question?
I mean, it's something I think about all the time. Uh-huh. I mean, I have things I want to write, but I don't know if it would be comics, you know. Whether it would just be, it might just be stuff I do and put out as, like, on Kindle or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I have some, like, middle grade, like, young adult kind of novels I plink around on and just need to I don't finish things is my problem. Mm-hmm.
I hear you, dog.
I've got a couple picture books I want to do before my son gets too old to appreciate them, you know. I mentioned it earlier, but and also the idea of all my hobbies end up becoming too much of a serious pursuit. Running a Dungeons and Dragons campaign for a bunch of creatives has made me want to, like, figure out how to maybe do something in the, like, tabletop sphere a little bit, because I feel like my it's been therapeutic, the social aspect of it, but also the idea of getting a bunch of people together and creating a story together through kind of improv, like, mm-hmm. has become kind of like a crucial part of, like, my what kind of gives me joy, like, in being creative in a way that, like, and my job does, mm-hmm. but it's still kind of a support role a little bit. And there's also something about making a story with your friends that just for the hell of it, just because you're all having a blast, that has been very good for me. And I kind of want to figure out a way to make that a thing, whether that's a job, I don't know, mm-hmm. In some way or a side hustle or whatever. I like that. I like that community. I like that sphere, and I'm kind of looking at maybe what could be done there. So
it's really cool. I like that as an answer, as a sort of, you know, like, well, these are other creative outlets that can help you feel fulfilled, and you've got a lot of options.
Yeah, and, like, I just always have things going, and, like, for me, it almost doesn't matter if they get finished. It's just the act of doing them is, like, my therapy.
Yeah, no, I get it.
My skills are varied enough that I could do a bunch of different things. But right now I'm still always looking for the, like, magical rhythm of just enough work. And the right kind of work that makes me feel kind of fulfilled, but I'm really ready to have more of a life. And, like, having a 3-year-old has made me, like, cherish being outdoors and, like, doing things again, yeah. in a way that I haven't done in a few years. So I'm wanting to reconnect with that almost more than I am wanting to, like, pursue any one thing. So balance. It's balance. That's what I want to do.
Well, I wish you luck then.
Well, I appreciate that.
Thanks so much. This was really fun talking to you. I'm glad we got to do this.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me.
And that'll do it for another episode of iFanboys Talksplode. I want to thank Jordan Boyd, who is, you know, above all, he's a great colorist. I hope that was interesting for everyone. I learned stuff about coloring that I did not know there. I hope that it's a little another piece of the comic book process that maybe people can come to appreciate a little bit more. If you want to comment on the show or see anything else that we've done, listen to other Talksplodes, all that podcast stuff, get over to ifanboy.com. If you want to follow Jordan on Twitter, he's at Jordan T. Boyd. And that'll do. Thanks very much. Thanks to the patrons for supporting the show, and everyone else for listening. Talk to you later.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.